Good afternoon, Mr. Flatley.
Good afternoon, Miss Kearns.
Rather than do things chronologically, perhaps go in reverse order. Let me just start with a few of the last items that Mr. Pantone asked you about. Mr. Flatley, you testified that you are the name holder of about 970,000 shares of Illumina stock, correct?
That's correct.
What was your personal monetary investment? In other words, how much did you pay for those shares of stock?
Objection. Relevance.
Overruled.
I've paid $175,000 to buy those shares.
And like any shares, the ultimate value of those shares is dependent on what the market does, right?
What the market does, whether the company makes it.
Now, Mr. Flatley, Mr. Pantone was asking you about the termination meeting, and he asked you about what you communicated to Dr. Zarnik about the reasons for the termination. You remember that?
Yes.
Regardless of what was exactly communicated to Dr. Zarnik verbally, you indicated that you also, in that same meeting, handed him a termination memo?
That's correct.
Can we have that exhibit put up, please?
What exhibit is this, counsel?
334. Is this the termination memo to which you're referring?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Flatley, you were asked about in deposition, you were asked about reasons, and I sense from your testimony under Mr. Pantone's questioning that there were some additional reasons that played into your decision to terminate, which you wanted to talk about.
Yes. We can phrase all this under the general category of did he meet these objectives? But when you assign someone objectives, and even at Illumina, we all assign objectives that are aggressive, and there's been a lot of testimony about that. So my measurement of Tony Zarnik's performance against his objectives included, what did he actually achieve, and what level of effort did he put into making those objectives?
And in many cases in science, you have an objective. You work on the beginning part of that objective, and you realize maybe it's an absolutely impossible one in terms of some law of physics. So you change it or replace it with some other objective.
So one thing that's incredibly important is how much effort is somebody making to try to achieve their objectives. And that was a very serious factor in my decision to terminate Dr. Zarnik.
So would you agree with me that what you communicated to Tony Zarnik in the termination meeting about the reasons for the termination was split between what you said out loud and what was in the memo that you handed to him during that meeting?
That's correct.
Objection. Leading.
Sustained.
Can you read for me?
Can I have that stricken from the record, please?
Just in the interest of saving time, I'm sure she could ask a non-leading question.
I'll ask a new one. You provided this Exhibit 334 to Tony Zarnik in real time in the termination meeting?
Yes.
Can you please read for me what you communicated to Dr. Zarnik next to last sentence in the first paragraph?
I provided you with 30-day, 60-day, 90-day, and 12-month goals, and have met with you on nearly a weekly basis since the meeting which you and I had on May 19, 2000. Since that time, your progress toward the goals has been insufficient. Many of your 30-day goals have still not been met.
And the 30-day goals to which you are referring on the date that you have the termination meeting, you were past the 90-day one, correct?
Yes, we were at about 100 days at that point.
Thank you. Now let me ask you, Mr. Flatley, we took a look. Mr. Pantone put up the blow-up of your handwritten notes reflecting a conversation which you and I had, correct?
Correct.
Can you explain to the jury why, if I suggested to you that you make that first statement about decoding, why you ultimately did not do so?
Yes. We had talked about the company's intellectual property. And the second statement on that talking point documented had to do with the fact that Dr. Zarnik has signed a proprietary information agreement with the company, and the fact that we expected Dr. Zarnik to live by the terms of that agreement. In other words, we didn't want him talking about our confidential information outside the walls of Illumina. And in the discussion with him, I reaffirmed his obligation to live by that confidentiality agreement. And anything having to do with decoding was included and embodied in that statement already. So I didn't feel any need to specifically call out decoding because there are a lot of other confidential issues Dr. Zarnik was aware of.
All right. Let me jump back now very briefly. Mr. Pantone didn't ask you any question about your own educational background or work history. Can I ask you to summarize in very short form your educational background, beginning with college?
Sure. I graduated in 1975 from a program that was a cooperative program between Claremont McKenna College and Stanford University. After 5 years of this pre-organized program, I graduated with a bachelor's degree in economics, bachelor's degree in industrial engineering, and master's degree in industrial engineering. Then I went to work for Spectrophysics in the analytical instrumentation industry. I held positions in engineering and manufacturing for them. Engineering and manufacturing. Then I worked for 3 years with Manning Technologies, where I was executive vice president, reported to the owner and CEO of that company. I went on to work for Plexus Computers, which was another startup company, so this is my second startup company. There, I held positions of vice president manufacturing, another period vice president of engineering, and vice president of strategic planning. I left that company in 1987 to found another startup called Molecular Dynamics. I started in an operations vice president role there, became president and CEO in 1994, took the company public in 1993, and eventually sold that company in 1998 to a company called Amersham Pharmacia Biotech. I was under contract with Amersham for 1 year to do the integration of Molecular Dynamics with Amersham, and that 1 year contract was expired in September of 1999. And then I joined Illumina in October of 1999.
And jumping back to your educational period of time, did you receive any academics honors or awards?
I did. I was summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa, which are honor societies. I also won the Frederick Terman Engineering Award at Stanford, which is the top two students in each of the different engineering departments in the university.
Are you married?
I am.
Do you have any children?
I have three and expecting another one in October.
So, from your recitation of your work history, before joining Illumina then, you had executive managerial experience before?
A substantial executive experience, yes.
You'd also been with a number of startup companies before joining Illumina, correct?
Illumina is my fourth startup company.
Mr. Pantone asked you about your joining and, in fact, founding a company called Molecular Dynamics?
That's right.
That company went public, true?
It did.
At the time that that company went public, were all of the founders still on board with the company?
No. There were three founders in total, and only two of us were with the company at that point. I should also mention that company was in the life science industry, so it was directly related to the type of technology that Illumina is involved in.
Now, during your early days at Illumina, you've already testified that your actual start date was October 18th, 1999, correct?
That's correct.
At the time, were you living in San Diego on a permanent residency basis?
No. Molecular Dynamics was in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'd lived there since I graduated in college in 75, so my residence was in the Bay Area.
How is it you were working at Illumina while you still lived in the Bay Area?
That was really the only issue with me joining Illumina, that it wasn't close to home. So I commuted to Illumina for about a year and a half and went back and forth twice a week to the Bay Area.
So you commuted back and forth from the Bay Area to San Diego twice a week?
That's right. And my wife was still working in the Bay Area.
Approximately, including commuting, approximately how many hours a week were you working?
Including commuting?
Yes.
Well, probably 70 or 80.
Did you do Illumina work while you were commuting on the plane?
Yes.
Let's put up Exhibit 85. Let's blow it up, please. Move it up and I think blow it up a little further. This is from Exhibit 85. Mr. Flatley, do you recognize this as an email sent by Dr. Zarnik to you on Friday, September 24th?
Yes, I do.
Do you remember receiving this email?
Yes.
Why is it memorable?
Well, I was at the company, as I mentioned earlier, for only about 3 days before I actually started on October 18th. And this was one of the days I came to Illumina to be introduced to the company. And I met with all the senior managers before actually starting. And this is an email I received just as I was about to leave to fly back to the Bay Area. It struck me very funny that I receive an email from Tony about work hours actually before I even started my employment with Illumina. So it just struck me as very odd.
And in this message, he's basically telling you that he needs or he's wanting to take the time out during the business day to go swimming. Is that right?
That's right.
Did you ever receive any kind of communication of this nature from any of the other senior managers before you began working at Illumina?
Not before and not after.
Let's go back to the full exhibit, please. Let's highlight Jay's response. Let me ask you, Mr. Flatley, do you recognize this as your response to the email that you had received from Dr. Zarnik about his desire to swim during the business day?
Yes, I do.
And let me... What were you trying to communicate to him about work scheduling?
My general point here was that I don't require people to be in the office any specific time during the day. I require, number one, that they perform very well, that they are in the office during normal core hours, but that I grant them a little flexibility on those hours if they have special circumstances.
And the question that you put to Dr. Zarnik was, have you had any prior input from John on this that has you concerned? Correct?
That's right.
Did you ever receive any response to that question from Dr. Zarnik?
Never heard anything back on that.
Now let's jump ahead to the time, point in time, when you've actually come on board at Illumina. And you testified on examination by Mr. Pantone when he called you as a witness in his case that on a number of occasions, Dr. Zarnik said, in effect, unless I hear back from you to the contrary, I'm going to assume I'm doing an excellent job. Do you remember that?
That's right.
Did this strike you as unusual?
Objection. Relevance.
Overruled.
Struck me as very unusual. We had these conversations a number of times in the first few weeks, and very quickly I was getting a perception of an employee who was highly insecure about his job. In fact, he sent me an email my very first day on the job, already wanting to schedule a lunch to talk about things like this. So I found it, particularly for someone in a senior executive position, to be highly odd in my mind.
That brings me to an interesting point. You have sat through every day of trial thus far, correct?
Correct.
And in fact, you'll be unable to do that during the 2 days we're in session next week, right?
Right.
But you were here during the entirety of Dr. Zarnik's testimony, correct?
Correct.
You heard Dr. Zarnik testify in his direct that you had been at the company for a few weeks and you didn't seem to be conferring with him as a CSO, and that's what prompted him to invite you to lunch, correct?
Correct.
In fact, it was your very first day on the job that he asked you to lunch.
Yes, that's right. And I was not there prior, other than to a few specific occasions for very specific reasons.
Now, you also testified, Mr. Flatley, that sometime much earlier than the Daly's dinner meeting in February 2000, you testified on examination by Mr. Pantone that Tony Zarnik had made a standing offer to step down as CSO if and when you deemed it appropriate.
That's right.
Did you set the context? Tell us when that discussion or when that topic was first raised.
Sure. I don't remember the exact date of that, but we had multiple one-on-one meetings, including this initial lunch we had during the first 4 weeks of my employment there. And during those meetings, we talked about all sorts of different things that Tony was interested in, about the technology, about the company, about his role, about his hours, things of that nature. And during one of those meetings, he basically told me that he had put in place a standing offer to step down as CSO, and that he realized the company was focused on genomics. That is not his area of expertise, and that was an open offer on his part, and very noble of him to take that position.
So did he present it that he had made this standing offer even before you arrived at Illumina?
Yes, that was the context of how he described it.
Objection, hearsay.
Sustained.
Now, upon, what was your, you said you felt it was a noble gesture at that time, whatever point in time Dr. Zarnik first communicated to you that he was willing to step down as CSO at any time. Did you have any intention at that moment of taking him up on his offer?
No, I had no reason to think anything about that.
And was it your understanding in your early days at Illumina that as CSO, Tony Zarnik was responsible for the overall leadership of the research and development program?
Exactly.
Did you, in all of the time that Dr. Zarnik was CSO, up until his change to research fellow, did you see him do anything to lead the entire research program?
Not at all. Tony never functioned as a CSO in this company. I didn't know that when I arrived there, but it didn't take long for me to realize that Tony was not acting or functioning in a CSO role at Illumina.
Let's talk about, say, the end of the first month of your employment, which would have been late November 1999. Did you hold a strategic off-site meeting with your senior managers?
I did. That was around the 22nd of November, I believe.
Where did that meeting take place?
I rented an apartment close by the office, and that apartment had a downstairs conference room, so I rented out that conference room for a day and had all my senior management team come over for a full-day strategic meeting.
I think the jury knows the senior management team, but could you identify the persons who attended that meeting?
Tony, John Stupnagel, Mark Chi, Rich Pytalewski, and Michael Lebla were also included in many of the management meetings, and I believe he was at that meeting as well as myself, of course.
I'll ask you to keep your voice up, please.
Pull this up a little closer.
Yes. What was the purpose of this meeting?
The purpose of the meeting was to do strategic planning for the company. One thing I realized when I got there pretty quickly, the company was engaged in a very large number of projects. We probably had 20 different projects underway, and the projects were kind of fragmented between different groups and different people working on multiple projects. So I wanted to have a meeting where we reviewed all of those, reviewed the relative priority, staffing levels on each, business potential of each of those, and begin to formulate for the company how we were going to get products on the market, what those products might look like, who was going to have responsibility for delivering on those objectives.
Did you prepare any form of agenda or schedule before the meeting?
Of course. We had a full agenda. We had done a significant amount of work to prepare for that meeting. Schedules, backing up all the projects, and those were all input to the meeting.
Let's put up Exhibit 100. In broad form, do you recognize this document, Mr. Flatley, as the agenda for the strategic on-site meeting?
Yes.
And did you provide this agenda to the meeting participants in advance of the meeting?
Yes.
Are you able to estimate how far in advance?
We certainly began discussing it probably 2 weeks before the meeting. We probably confirmed the final version some number of days before that, but the assignments of who was to work on what were given at least a week in advance.
At least a week in advance, the people who are identified as discussion leaders had advance notice of which topic or topics they would be responsible for leading the discussion about?
That's correct.
And what topic did you assign for Tony Zarnik to lead the discussion on?
We call this an early access program. This is a particular strategy of getting products to market where you let certain customers have access to your technology earlier than the general group of customers. Because you gave this early access, you get premium price. It's a way of getting technology that isn't fully developed into the market early and in a profitable way.
What were your expectations in terms of the level of preparation that was to be done by each discussion leader concerning his topic or topics?
I would have expected them to do some prior research to make sure at a minimum they understood what everybody else on the staff knew about that particular topic, that they might consult with people outside the company, that they might hold some sub-meetings to talk with other people in the company about that, and to come prepared with a small presentation. I wasn't looking for a 50-page presentation here, but content related to that topic that represented the company's best thinking on that issue at that point.
What level were you satisfied with the level of preparation done by Tony Zarnik with respect to the topic he was given?
None at all.
Did he prepare any written materials?
Nothing that I recall.
Did he prepare any PowerPoint slides or blow-ups?
Nothing that I recall.
Did he lead the discussion?
He led the discussion in the sense that I said, okay, Tony, it's now yours, and he took it from there. But that was really just asking questions and trying to be a facilitator, not a leader of topic itself.
Did he make any concrete contributions or suggestions during the discussion on his topic?
Nothing whatsoever.
Did Dr. Zarnik make significant contributions or suggestions in connection with any of the other discussions?
Well, He probably did on some of the other topics, but he didn't necessarily come prepared with any materials on those other topics. In general, what I came away from this meeting with was a sense that Dr. Zarnik had no strategic vision, that he was a tactical person, that he couldn't integrate broadly the company's strategy and develop strategic views on how to get that technology to market, what customers to go after, how to price it, position it in the marketplace. During this meeting, he was silent because he had no input on those topics.
What was the level of preparation that appeared to have been engaged in by the other presenters, the other discussion leaders?
Objection, relevance.
Sustained.
Did other decision leaders provide written materials?
Same objection.
Sustained.
Was it your impression that in leading his discussion, Dr. Zarnik was essentially winging it?
Yes.
Did you at some point express to him your dissatisfaction with his contributions at this meeting?
I did.
When did that happen?
Over the next few weeks, I talked to Tony about this meeting, and in addition to his contribution, he was also late for the meeting, so he didn't get there when the meeting was supposed to start.
And he was late to the strategic meeting?
Yes, he was. It was only 3 blocks from the office.
When you talked to Dr. Zarnik about your dissatisfactions concerning his performance and his lack of contribution at this strategic meeting, in that verbal counseling session, did you address any other performance concerns, or was that discussion limited only to a discussion of this strategic meeting?
That discussion was probably in the context of a number of other subjects. I don't recall any other specific counseling at that meeting, but it would have been wrapped into other discussions on other topics.
Do you distinctly remember that at some point after November 22nd, you did communicate to Dr. Zarnik verbally that you were unhappy with his level of preparation and contribution during this strategic offsite?
Yes.
Any question in your mind whether you did that?
No, none whatsoever.
Why didn't you document that discussion and put it in his personnel file?
Well, this was the first kind of tangible performance issue that I had had with regard to Tony. The other things were very soft. Things about the insecurity of his job and things of that nature, and his work hour request. So this was really the first tangible indication, so I didn't feel a need to put a formal warning in a file. That's a fairly serious step when you get to a formal warning.
Were you hoping that the verbal counseling would be sufficient to get him to contribute more and prepare better?
I was. I thought and hoped at this point that really all it was that he didn't understand my expectations, and that maybe, somehow, John was much more lax than I was and didn't have high expectations, and I was just new with the company, so I didn't know how John had run it before I got there. So I thought once I communicated what my expectations were to Tony, he'd immediately be able to step up and deliver to my expectation.
Let's jump ahead a little bit in time, but still probably during calendar year 1999. Did you ever have an occasion in which you received any kind of client or collaborator complaint about Tony Zarnik's performance?
Yes.
Objection, hearsay.
Goes to Mr. Flatley's state of mind and the reasons that played into the termination decision ultimately.
It'll be limited to his state of mind and not offered for the truth of the matter.
Did you receive any customer complaints, or I should say collaborator complaint, about Dr. Zarnik's performance?
Yes, I had a very direct one. Tony was responsible for our collaboration with Chevron, and there was a meeting scheduled on site at Illumina with representatives from Chevron. Meet with our scientists at Illumina to discuss the status of the project. And the head officer of that collaboration, after a series of morning meetings, put in a request through my assistant to have a personal one-on-one meeting with me that afternoon. In that meeting, we kind of discussed the collaboration in general, but very specifically, he told me that he was very disappointed with the leadership that Dr. Zarnik had provided on the Chevron collaboration.
What was, to your understanding, what was Dr. Zarnik's role vis-a-vis the Chevron collaboration?
He was the lead person for Illumina on the Chevron collaboration.
And did this Chevron representative indicate to you the nature of the disappointment or dissatisfaction?
Yes, there were a couple of things. One is that there was a work plan that was supposed to have been provided to Chevron from Illumina, and that he said that that responsibility had been going on for 6 months, and Tony had not delivered anything tangible against that requirement. And, in addition, he was disappointed at the pace of the project.
Did you personally review the content of the work plan that Tony Zarnik provided to Chevron?
I did. And when I looked at that work plan, I was very disappointed as well. So I could see the customer's reasons for complaining about the work plan.
Why were you disappointed with the content of the work plan?
Because it was incredibly superficial. It had a few pages of work tasks that were not creative at all. Anybody could have listed those. And this really began to help me understand how Tony approached these kinds of assignments. And what he would do is create a very superficial outline and then route it to everyone else in the company to get comments and feedback. And often, he didn't get any because it would require the other people to actually create the original content. Instead of offering input and feedback on the content that was there, there generally was no content. So people would have to author things originally. So the Chevron plan was just like that. It was a sketchy outline, no content, no milestones, no budgets, and it didn't have the kind of things the customer was looking for, which was, in fact, the most important dimension of a plan like this, is what the customer wants.
You came to learn that it was the standard procedure for Dr. Zarnik to create an outline and then send it out, in your words, to everybody in the company for feedback. You mean literally he sent it to every person in the company?
No, the people that were associated with the project.
Okay, so he sent it out to everybody on the team.
On the team, yes.
Let's now jump ahead to the January 2000 timeframe. We've heard testimony that there was a scientific advisory board meeting in January 2000, correct?
Correct.
This is the first one which you had attended since joining Illumina.
The first one that had been held since I joined.
What level... Dr. Zarnik, as CSO, was responsible for organizing and planning this meeting?
Yes.
What level of preparation, or what degree of preparation, were you expecting from Dr. Zarnik in advance of this SAB meeting?
I was expecting him to bring up at one of our weekly staff meetings a discussion of what was going to happen at the upcoming SAB, to solicit input from people on what the agenda topic and organization's dimensions of that meeting might be, to put together any social interactions with the SAB, whether it was going to be a breakfast or a dinner, and then to gather the appropriate sets of inputs from people in the company and publish those out to the SAB in advance, so people flying in from around the world, in fact, we had somebody from Australia that was flying in, to have a chance to think about these problems and opportunities and be well prepared for the meeting.
Let's put up Exhibit 115. Mr. Flatley, is this Exhibit 115 an email, the bottom part, this portion, is this an email sent to you from you to Tony Zarnik on January 18th at 2:05 in the afternoon?
Yes, meeting was Friday, and I was beginning to get alarmed by the fact that there had been no discussion or agenda about the meeting on Friday.
And so on Tuesday, you were wondering, so is it accurate to say that at the time you sent this email, you had not been provided with any agenda either in draft or final form?
That's correct.
Dr. Zarnik responded to you about 4 hours later?
Yes.
And he indicated that there was not an agenda yet, correct?
That's correct.
And did Dr. Zarnik, in this first portion of his response, he said that much of the meeting will be people at Illumina setting up their problem, posing it, then being present to hear the discussion. Do you see that?
I do.
When you read that, did you have any concern with the concept of scientists from Illumina presenting problems to the SAB, posing their problems, and then remaining to hear the discussion about the problems?
In fact, that's the purpose of an SAB. You want to present what your scientific challenges are to the SAB, get outside input, direction, third-hand observations from the SAB.
Now, I notice that on the communication from you to Tony Zarnik, which you are asking him whether there's an agenda, you copied John Stulpnagel and Mark Chi. Why is that?
Because I wanted to know whether somehow I was being left out of the loop on this, and maybe I was the only one that hadn't gotten it. So I wanted there to be a general awareness we didn't have an agenda, and also give John an opportunity, if he had set some other standard for this meeting, for him to let me know that.
Did you ever instruct Dr. Zarnik at any time before this SAB meeting to obtain the approval of Dr. Stulpnagel and or Chi on the agenda?
No.
Did you ask Tony Zarnik to prepare the agenda and submit it to you?
Well, I expected him to submit it to me. In this email, I was directly asking him to submit it to me.
Did you ever direct, I just want to make sure there was no confusion on Dr. Zarnik's part. Did you ever instruct him to submit the proposed agenda to John or Mark for advance review before giving it to you?
No.
Did you ever tell Dr. Zarnik to submit the agenda to Dr. Stulpnagel and Chi in lieu of to you?
No.
You've testified that you didn't have any problem with including on the agenda a discussion period for technical problems?
None at all.
So let's focus then on the conduct of the January SAB meeting. As of Tuesday evening, Dr. Zarnik was telling you there wasn't an agenda yet. Did you ultimately receive an agenda before the start of the SAB meeting?
Before Tuesday and the start of the meeting on Friday, I asked Dr. Zarnik verbally on a couple more occasions what the status of this was, because my alarm was going up that we had no preparation. The first agenda I ever saw was between 9 and 10 o'clock. I was still in the office on Thursday night, just before the SAB was to start the next Friday morning. He came in and asked me, "Here's the agenda. What do you think?"
So you were being given the agenda to review for the first time at 9 or 10 o'clock the night before the meeting?
That's right.
Did you have any changes to the agenda at that time?
It was too late to make any changes to the agenda. The SAB members were going to have it. I asked him, "How are you going to get this to the members?" He said, "I was going to slide it under the door of their hotel rooms, so maybe someone would be able to look at it over breakfast, but that was the extent of the possible review. So it wasn't even worth commenting on at that point."
Did Dr. Zarnik provide to you this Thursday night any reading materials or articles that were going to be provided to the SAB members?
No. There was no package whatsoever, only an agenda.
Were you present at the start of the SAB meeting?
Yes, I was.
Who kicked off the SAB meeting?
Tony kicked it off.
Do you remember any of his opening remarks?
I do distinctly.
What did he say?
He stood up and introduced me as the new CEO of the company, gave a couple of introductory remarks to the SAB members, and then Tony promptly apologized for the fact we didn't have an agenda and said, "This must be a remnant of my academic training," and basically dismissed out of hand the fact that we didn't have an agenda for the meeting.
Were you disappointed with Dr. Zarnik's level of preparation for the meeting?
I would say I was more than disappointed. I found it personally embarrassing. This is my first SAB meeting as CEO, and I thought we had begun this very poorly, and I was embarrassed for the company and for Tony.
Did any member of the SAB meeting ever communicate to you any dissatisfaction with the way that meeting was run?
Yes.
Objection. Hearsay.
Sustained.
Do you know one way or another whether Dr. David Walt ever sought to have breakfast with Tony Zarnik shortly after this SAB meeting?
Calls for hearsay.
I think he can answer yes or no.
Yes.
Do you know one way or another who initiated the breakfast meeting?
I do, yes.
Who was that?
Calls for hearsay.
I think it's going to be hearsay, unless there's some...
I think it's not being offered for the truth of the matter. I mean to the extent that I want to bring in what Dr. Walt reported about that breakfast meeting. It's not for the truth of the matter. It goes, though, to show the impressions that Jay Flatley formed and his state of mind, and Mr. Pantone has certainly explored the reasons and the timing of the decision to appoint a new CSO, and this is directly relevant.
It'll be received for state of mind only, not for the truth of the matter.
So, Mr. Flatley, again, focusing on, you've heard the statement I made to the court, so we want to focus on your state of mind. But what did you learn from David Walt about the, what did David Walt say to you about the SAB meeting, and what sort of state of mind did that create in you?
I obviously came away from the SAB meeting very disappointed personally, and David told me in a phone conversation that he was also extremely disappointed in the meeting. He went through a series of specifics of where he thought the meeting was poorly prepared, or in some cases irrelevant, commented specifically on the fact there was no agenda, and wrapped up with his impressions of Tony's performance, that he was performing a ceremonial role in the company, disengaged, not motivated, and didn't seem to be excited or interested in staying with Illumina.
And what sort of state of mind did that create for you, in you?
Well, it created a terrific degree of uncertainty about Tony's status in the company for me at that point. David corroborated essentially or validated my views of what had happened at the SAB meeting. David Walt was not only a member of the SAB, but also a member of the board of directors and inventor of this technology. And here he was telling me our CSO was disengaged and performing a ceremonial role in the company. So I took that very seriously. I began thinking at that point that I had a potential serious problem on my hands, and I needed to begin thinking about what I was going to do about that.
And was there some discussion between you and David Walt at this point in time about the concept of him having breakfast with Tony Czarnik?
Yes. David proposed that to me because David had been longtime friends with Tony and thought that over a breakfast meeting that he may be able to talk to Tony about these issues and understand more clearly what, if anything, was behind them.
Did you think that was a good idea?
I thought it was a great idea. So David went ahead and scheduled that.
And did you make any memorialization of your conversation with David Walt?
I did.
I'm obviously looking for that memorialization, but I'll come back to that later in our examination, perhaps after a short break. So did you have an understanding that the breakfast meeting between Dr. Walt and Dr. Czarnik did occur?
Yes, it did.
Again, same question. What did Dr. Walt tell you about that breakfast? And what kind of state of mind in you did that information create?
Objection, hearsay.
Again, it's
limited to state of mind, not for the truth, not to be considered by the jury to prove the truth of what was said, but just evidence of how it affected Mr. Flatley's state of mind regarding the defendant.
So David reported back to me that they had indeed had the breakfast. David had talked to Tony about the SAB meeting and his general level of disengagement with the company, and Tony had proceeded to more or less rationalize away each of those specific concerns. In fact, I got back from Tony a report about that meeting, as well as an email from him, where he went by point and rationalized each of those concerns about the SAB meeting. So I came away thinking from this, not only do I have someone who has a performance problem in the company, but he's not self-aware at all about the fact that he did. So he didn't stand up and say, okay, tell me what I did wrong, how can I make it better, how can I change and make this, accept responsibility for the things I did incorrectly. He basically rationalizes, I wasn't disengaged. He went on and on about that.
Let's put up Exhibit 124. Mr. Flatley, you said moments ago you had gotten email feedback from Tony Czarnik on the breakfast with David Walt, correct?
Correct.
Do you recognize this portion, a portion of this document, to be Tony Czarnik's email to you regarding the breakfast?
Yes.
And in this statement, Dr. Czarnik says to you that during the breakfast with David Walt, several misconceptions regarding the SAB meeting were addressed, right?
Right.
Did you view Dr. Czarnik's use of the word misconceptions to reflect the fact that he wasn't hearing the feedback that was being given to him by David Walt?
Exactly.
Calls for speculation.
I asked for Mr. Flatley's interpretation. Mr. Flatley, you testified then that as a result of the report you got back from David Walt concerning Tony Czarnik's response to these criticisms, you formed a state of mind where you were very concerned that you had a senior manager who not only had a performance problem, but didn't recognize that he did.
Objection. Leading.
Sustained.
He already testified to that. Would you say that after receiving the feedback... Let me strike that. After receiving the feedback from David Walt concerning the breakfast he'd had with Tony Czarnik, were you more concerned, less concerned, or holding the same degree of concern you'd had about Tony Czarnik's ability to function as CSO in the company?
My concern had been increasing all along. After this, it was acute, I would say. It was a very serious concern about him holding that role. And in fact, functionally, he was not actually performing the role at this point in time.
Let me show to counsel. This was marked as a deposition exhibit. Your Honor, I have Mr. Flatley's handwritten notes reflecting his initial phone call. Excuse me, let me make my statement. I'm not going to read them in yet.
I think we can do this at the next break.
You want to take it up right now? Take a break?
I'd rather keep going and come back to it if need be.
Okay.
So after getting feedback from David Walt concerning his breakfast with Tony Zarnik and Dr. Zarnik's rationalization concerning the SAB, what did you decide to do in response to what you had learned?
I decided to schedule a dinner meeting with Tony that we could verbally discuss these issues one-on-one and talk to him about the future of his role at Illumina. It had been indicated to me through David he was disengaged. I wanted to understand that and talk about what I thought was going to need to happen.
And one issue that was raised in Mr. Pantone's examination of you is that you have this dinner meeting with Dr. Zarnik at Daly's on February 7th, 2000, correct?
That's correct.
And he asked you whether you told Dr. Zarnik at that dinner meeting that you had already spoken with David Barker about the possibility of Dr. Barker joining Illumina. Do you remember that?
Yes.
First, let me ask you, is it accurate you in fact had spoken with Dr. Barker about the possibility of his joining Illumina?
Yes, I have.
That conversation occurred before the Daly's dinner?
Correct.
Why didn't you tell Tony Zarnik in that dinner meeting that you'd already had a communication with David Barker?
Well, I didn't feel a need to tell him about that communication. My discussion with David only related to whether David was a potential candidate for a CSO at Illumina. When I called him, I didn't know whether he had any interest in potentially joining Illumina. But after I'd seen this email from Tony, in my mind, I needed to begin to explore what my possibilities were in terms of finding a replacement CSO. The context is, we were marching, by this time, toward a public filing for an IPO, and I needed a management team in place that could lead a public company. So I needed to have somebody in a CSO role who could be very effective, both internally and external to the company.
Now let me ask you this. By the point in time at which you had the dinner meeting at Daly's, had you reached the conclusion that you did need a different CSO?
Yes, I had.
What were the reasons that you concluded Illumina needed a different CSO other than Dr. Zarnik?
There were multiple reasons. One, it was very clear Tony was not functioning as a CSO in the company. He didn't have the strategic knowledge of core applications, and frankly, he admitted that part of it he didn't understand. He had had the standing offer to step down as CSO, and of course, by this time, I had very serious specific performance problems with Tony's ability to deliver in any area. So it was a combination of not performing, not functioning that role, and not having the academic training to be the CSO that we needed as a public company.
And you mentioned the fact that you were hoping to have an IPO. Did the fact that the company was heading toward an IPO play into your conclusion that you needed a different CSO?
Well, I needed to really put together an entire management team. This was all happening very quickly, because the markets during this time period were very, very good for public offerings. So the board was very interested in me trying to get a public offering down. So not only did I need to get the financing in place, but I needed additional people into the management team to flush out a complete organization that would be presentable and allow us to do a very positive IPO. So filling the CSO role was one of those positions.
Now, in fact, Mr. Flatley, you say the markets were very hot at the time, and the board was very interested in pushing forward with an IPO.
Yes.
In fact, the company's IPO actually occurred July 28th, 2000, correct?
Correct.
Was that the original anticipated IPO date?
No, it wasn't.
What was the original anticipated IPO date?
Well, the objective was to get it done as fast as humanly possible. So we spent the entire month of March preparing this registration statement. And typically what happens is that you prepare that statement, you submit it to the SEC, you receive comment back, revise it, and you typically are able to start a roadshow about 30 days after you file the initial S-1, which would have put our roadshow, initial target for our roadshow, right at the beginning of May.
And in fact, the decision was made not to go forward with the IPO in May, correct?
That's correct.
To defer it until what ended up being late July?
That's correct.
And in fact, Had the company completed its IPO as originally anticipated in May, that would have occurred before the round of experiments that Kevin Gunderson was doing during the summer of 2000, correct?
Objection, leading.
It's kind of ponderous, isn't it?
It's already been leading for a long time.
I'll ask it another way. Had the 768 decode experiments, which were done by Kevin Gunderson, been completed as of May 2000?
No.
Now, you testified that you did have a particular potential candidate for new CSO in mind, and that was David Barker?
That's right.
Why did you have David Barker in mind?
David Barker had worked for me at Molecular Dynamics for quite some time, 10 or 11 years maybe, so I knew that he was very effective in that role. He had direct knowledge of our applications. He had been in the micro business before. He had IPO experience. He drafted an S-1 with me the prior time around, so he was ideally suited to join, if he was interested.
Now, a point I'd like to bring up from Mr. Pantone's examination of David Barker is, isn't it true, when David Barker worked with you at Molecular Dynamics, he never held the title Chief Scientific Officer?
That's correct, he didn't.
And all of the years that you were with Molecular Dynamics, was there a Chief Scientific Officer?
No, we didn't ever have a position like that. We called it something different.
What was David Barker's title, if you recall?
We called it VP of Advanced Research or Advanced Development, something like that.
In the years in which David Barker served in that role, did he serve as the top-level scientific VP?
Yes, he did.
There was no other scientific position higher than that one?
No, top of the heap.
In that position, he's responsible for directing the overall scientific activity of that company?
Yes.
Having been in executive management in a number of companies, Mr. Flatley, is it the case that it's up to the company to decide what titles it's going to have? In other words, what positions it's going to have within it?
You mean how many of those positions are filled, how they are combined?
Whether you have a chief scientific officer or whether you call it something else.
Yes, different companies call them different things. If you are more biotech-oriented, CSO is more typical. Molecular Dynamics had a lot of instrumentation, so the advanced research role included not only the chemistry part of that, but a lot of the engineering, building instrumentation, so we chose a different title because of the orientation of the company.
Let's jump ahead to the Daly's dinner. You'd already had a discussion with David Barker on February 4th, correct?
Correct.
And he indicated to you that he would have some interest in joining Illumina?
That's right.
So what was your purpose? What was your intended purpose? Strike that. What was your intended content of discussion when you arrived at Daly's for the dinner with Dr. Zarnik?
As I stated earlier, Dr. Zarnik had volunteered to step down from the CSO role, and I was certainly prepared to take him up on that and make a change. However, I was much more concerned about the situation than that, in fact, because I think Tony's, when he offered up the CSO role, he thought what he would then step back to is VP of Chemistry. My assessment of him as a manager at that point was so low, I didn't believe any management position was suitable for Tony. So my goal was to try to move him into some other position in the company. So that dinner meeting was intended to be a direct performance counseling session with Tony, where I tell him about all the things that I was concerned about and explore what options we had for Tony in the company. My goal was to get that to be something that was in a non-management role.
So how did you start the discussion?
We started talking, a little small talk after we ordered. We started talking about what was going on in the company and the IPO process was moving along, and then we talked about the CSO role, and he reiterated his willingness to step down from that CSO role, particularly in light of the fact that we were about to start officially in the IPO process. Then I asked him, well, how important is a position that has management content to you? And I was trying to explore the working space I had here to try to deal with Tony as to whether that was an important component to him or not. He said that it wasn't significant and that he really loved working at Illumina. He wanted to continue to work at Illumina, that he'd do whatever he could to make it successful, and that he was willing to take a non-management role if required.
Who proposed the research fellow position, you or Dr. Zarnik?
Tony did.
And did he propose in this meeting any specific job responsibilities or duties?
No, we didn't get down to that level in this meeting.
Mr. Pantone asked you whether Illumina had an existing position for research fellow at the time, correct?
Correct.
And you didn't?
We did not.
Did you agree to create this position specifically to enable Dr. Zarnik to continue with Illumina?
We did. We didn't do that at that dinner meeting, but subsequently, when we made the change, yes, we created a new position for Tony.
Now, if Dr. Zarnik was not performing well as CSO, why is it that you were willing to create a research fellow position for him?
Well, Tony came well-credentialed in the field, and he had a lot of the scientists in the company liked Tony a lot. In fact, I liked Tony a lot, so we were searching for a way to keep Tony in the company. It was my belief, at least at that point, that he could make individual contributions to the company that were significant. He had a couple of inventions, and my hope was we could put him into a role where he could be very productive and continue on with Illumina forever.
So your primary concerns with his performance at that time related to strategic thinking, building business acumen, and leadership?
Objection, leading.
But it just summarizes what he said. We're trying to move things along.
Overruled or sustained?
Overruled.
You can answer.
Those are my areas of concern.
And at that time, did you have a concern about his ability to contribute on a scientific level?
Not specific. I mean, there had been some other kind of peripheral problems with regard to Tony and the company. I had hoped those would not be a factor in an individual contributor role, and that he would do well in a pure science spot.
Now, you've already testified that it was sometime later that you actually communicated to Dr. Zarnik that you would take him up on his offer to step down. Why didn't you accept the offer on the spot during the Daly's dinner?
Well, by that time, we knew we were going to start working on the IPO documents at the beginning of March. And to go public, you really do need to have a good team in place. So depending upon how fast I was able to get a replacement, we could have made the decision to keep Tony in the CSO role for some amount of time while we did the public offering, if that was required. So what I began to do after the dinner was to really look carefully to see whether I could come to an agreement with David Barker to join the company. If I was able to have David join the company, then we could move quickly and make it happen before the IPO instead of after.
By the time of the Daly's dinner, then, David Barker had expressed an interest, correct?
That's right.
Had you engaged in any negotiations with David Barker by that point?
None at all.
So is it fair to say that although David Barker expressed interest, you didn't have any guarantee that you'd be able to get him?
Well, in fact, it was worse than that. In fact, I had an agreement as part of my departure with Molecular Dynamics that I wouldn't go to people inside of Molecular Dynamics and hire them away. David, at that point, was working for Amersham for the CEO, and so it was very clear that if there was any chance of me getting David, that I had to negotiate this directly with Amersham, not just with David. So during that subsequent period, I actually entered into a discussion with the CEO of Amersham, and basically had to get permission to take him from the company. The reason he granted that was David was going to leave anyway. David wasn't enjoying his role there, and the CEO knew that, so he granted me permission to take David away. But that took some time to get in place.
You didn't make any firm offer to David Barker until you determined that Amersham would let you take him?
That's right.
You said, Mr. Flatley, one of your intended topics to discuss during dinner was discussion about Dr. Zarnik's performance issues, correct?
Right.
Did you have that discussion during this Daly's dinner?
Well, I didn't go into all the things that I had originally planned to go into, so we talked a little about the SAB, a little about Chevron, because Tony basically agreed very quickly to step down to this research fellow position that we began to talk about. Most of the other performance issues became irrelevant, so I didn't feel a need to dive down into those difficult problems there.
You were more focusing on moving forward.
Yes. There was a lot going on, and I needed to move quickly. And my hope was everything was going to get resolved, and we're going to work out fine.
Was there any discussion whatsoever during this dinner meeting about Dr. Zarnik's history of depression?
No.
Was there any discussion whatsoever during this dinner meeting about medications?
No, that didn't come up.
Any discussion during this dinner meeting about an unspecified medical condition?
No.
Do you have any doubt in your mind about your testimony and your answers to the last three questions?
No. None whatsoever.
When is it in relation to the Daly's dinner that you finally did communicate to Dr. Zarnik that you'd take him up on his offer and have him step down as CSO?
That meeting occurred on March 1st.
And in this meeting, you told him that you were taking him up on the offer, correct?
That's right.
Is it in this meeting you also communicated to him that you would be making changes in his compensation?
Yes, I did.
Now, Mr. Flatley, we've heard testimony from Dr. Zarnik about the change in compensation. Let me ask you, what exactly did you tell him in this meeting about the changes in compensation?
I told him that it was my intention to reduce his salary and to reduce his stock, and to do that commensurate with the change to research fellow.
The proposed change in salary was a reduction from $185,000 to $165,000 a year?
That's right.
A little over a 10% reduction?
Yes, that's about right.
Did Dr. Zarnik express any resistance or opposition to that change during this meeting?
No.
When you communicated to Dr. Zarnik during March, the meeting on March 1st, 2000, an intention to reduce his stock vesting, did he in that meeting express any opposition to the concept?
No, he did not in that meeting.
Why did you feel that reductions in salary and stock were called for given the change in position?
Tony was the highest compensated person in the company other than myself, and clearly by that time I had drawn the conclusion his contribution, actual contribution, was distinctly different than that of John and Mark in particular. And one of the responsibilities I have as CEO is to maintain equity among people inside the company. So there were many people who knew what Tony's compensation was in the company. And particularly given the fact that he was stepping down to a lesser management role, I felt an adjustment in compensation was absolutely appropriate to maintain equity with people inside the company and with outside market conditions.
Now, on direct questioning by Mr. Pantone, you testified that you consulted with counsel other than me concerning the stock change, correct?
Yes.
You testified that that counsel told you that it could only be changed by agreement, right?
That's correct.
Your counsel didn't use the word illegal, correct?
No, they didn't.
Or not legal?
No.
So an agreement was presented to Dr. Zarnik, which he ultimately declined to sign, right?
Yes.
As a result, isn't it true his stock vesting was never changed?
It was never changed until termination.
Well, at that point it just stopped, correct?
The discussion stopped about changing his stock, yes.
And when Dr. Zarnik declined to sign the change of position agreement, did you say to him, you know what this means, don't you?
No, I did not.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
How am I doing on time, Your Honor?
I think you've gone about 45 minutes.
It's been an hour and 5 minutes.
Hour 5 minutes? You started at...
But who's counting? I stopped at 1:20 on the dot.
What is it, 1:20? I wrote 1:40. 1:20? So, it's an hour and 5 minutes. You want to take a break?
Is this a good time?
Sure.
We'll take our afternoon recess at this time.
It's always a good time.
We'll be in recess until 20 minutes before 3. Please remember the admonition not to form or express any opinion about the case, not to discuss the case. We'll be in recess until 20 minutes before 3. The record will indicate all the jurors are present, counsel and parties present. You may continue your examination, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let's put up Exhibit 143. Mr. Flatley, do you recognize this as an email you received from Dr. Zarnik on March 2nd?
Yes, I do.
This is the day after you communicated to him that he would become a research fellow and his salary and stock were proposed to be reduced?
That's right.
In this message, he says, most of what we discussed yesterday seems fine, but the stock offer is demonstrably incorrect based just on good accounting practice. I'll stop by this afternoon to explain why. And you respond, okay, correct?
Correct.
Now, any time after you communicated to Dr. Zarnik on March 1st that his salary would be reduced, Did he ever complain about that to you?
No.
And in fact, were you here when, did you personally, were you present when Dr. Zarnik said he didn't have an issue with the salary reduction?
Yes, I was.
Let's go to 144. Do you recognize this as an email communication between you and Dr. Zarnik the next day, March 3rd?
Yes.
And once again, Dr. Zarnik is taking the position that the proposed change in stock compensation is not appropriate or warranted, correct?
Correct.
He didn't say anything in this email or any other email about the salary change?
Correct.
Did Dr. Zarnik ever visit you and provide you with accounting practice data that demonstrated why his stock reduction wasn't appropriate?
No.
Now, just so that we're absolutely clear, is it true that Dr. Zarnik volunteered to step down as CSO?
That's right.
And Dr. Zarnik proposed taking on the position of research fellow, correct?
Correct.
I understand that Dr. Zarnik wasn't proposing either of these salary or stock reductions, but he didn't object to the salary reduction, correct?
That's right. He didn't object to the stock reduction in the first meeting either.
So would you say, Mr. Flatley, as of the Daly's dinner, Dr. Zarnik was agreeing if you chose to accept the offer. He was agreeing to step down to become a research fellow, correct?
Correct.
And he subsequently indicated that he didn't have any, in fact, in court, he indicated he didn't have a problem with the salary reduction issue.
That's correct.
Let's put up Exhibit 231. Let me just say in broad form, do you recognize this as the complaint of discrimination that was received by you at Illumina?
In broad form. It's hard to read from here.
I guess let's blow up the top part. It's also in your binder, 231.
Yes.
So do you recognize this as the complaint of discrimination filed by Tony Zarnik, which you ultimately received at Illumina?
Yes, but that's not the same document. There. Yes.
Let's scroll down to this first paragraph of particulars and blow that up. In this document, Exhibit 231, the DFEH charge, there's a representation by Dr. Zarnik to the DFEH, a governmental agency, that on or about March 14th, he was retaliated. I was again retaliated when demoted to research fellow earning $165,000 per year. Do you see that?
Yes, I do.
Is that an accurate characterization of the way by which Dr. Zarnik became a research fellow?
No. In fact, Dr. Zarnik had proposed the change to research fellow.
He offered to step down, correct?
Correct.
So he wasn't demoted, per se. He was... his offer to step down was accepted.
I guess I wouldn't say he offered to step down, but as part of our discussions, we'd agreed research fellow was the appropriate role, and he agreed that was the workable position for him.
This line, when it talks about retaliation, it's characterizing the change in position to research fellow as a retaliatory action, correct?
Correct.
Let's scroll down to the signature block. Mr. Flatley, when people file charges with the DFEH, they sign them, and they sign them under penalty of perjury. Do you recognize that as Dr. Zarnik's signature?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Pantone asked you whether Dr. Zarnik offered to or expressed an interest in taking a lead in your search for a new CSO. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Did you do a search for a new CSO?
No, I never conducted a search.
Why not?
Because I had in mind Dr. David Barker, who I thought was a perfect fit for the position. I knew how well he had performed for me prior, and by the time we brought him in, I knew he was interested in the job, so I had no need to do a search, and I was under a very tight time deadline to get the CSO position filled.
Your direct testimony was you told Dr. Zarnik you'd involve him in the process?
Yes, I told him when he asked me about being involved, I said I'd involve him in the process.
Did you ever tell him you'd involve him in a search?
No. I wasn't planning on doing a search if I could get David Barker on board.
Let's go to Exhibit 149. Do you recognize this as an email sent by Tony Zarnik to all of us, meaning all of Illumina, on March 8th, 2000?
Yes.
And Dr. Zarnik testified on direct that he sent out an email communication about his change of position at your suggestion. That's what he testified to on direct. Is that accurate?
Well, if it was my suggestion. He announced it at the morning R&D meeting. So he stood up and described to people at the R&D meeting the fact he was making this change and what his reasons were for making the change. And then we had agreed it would be appropriate to put out an email because there are people who don't attend that meeting, so everyone would know.
There's a line in which Dr. Zarnik says, Jay and I agreed my interests and, frankly, abilities lie on the science side. Did you insist that Dr. Zarnik include that verbiage, or is that his own wording?
No, he wrote this entire email. I didn't write it.
Thank you. Now let's focus on the resignation. On March 8th, Dr. Zarnik communicates to the entire company that he's changing positions and is accepting a position more consistent with his interests and ability, right?
Right.
You testified already that you believe it was in late March 2000 that he resigned.
That's right.
On or about the 22nd or 23rd?
That's correct.
When did this discussion between you and Dr. Zarnik take place?
What time of day?
Yes.
I don't actually remember what time of day it was.
What did Dr. Zarnik say to you, to the best of your recollection?
He came into my office, and he said to me that he was resigning his position at Illumina, and that he wanted to leave as soon as possible, and that the conditions at Illumina were intolerable for him.
Did he specify what conditions were intolerable?
No.
What was your response?
I was, frankly, pretty stunned by this. Because I thought things had gone pretty well, that I'd orchestrated a pretty smooth transition of Tony into the research fellow role. I thought that would work out well for the company. I was cautiously optimistic that he would contribute in that role, and I was frankly pleasantly surprised he came in and resigned.
And apart from your attorneys, did you tell anyone else that Dr. Zarnik had resigned?
I told John Stulpnagel.
Did he have a reaction?
He was equally surprised. This certainly isn't what either of us had anticipated at that point, and I was frankly still pretty early with the company. I had only been there about 5 months or so at that point. And so, for me, I was really very interested in Tony being successful, and the fact he was now going to be leaving the company. On the one hand, there were some positive things because there were performance issues. On the other hand, it wasn't necessarily the best thing for me that somebody senior in the company was about to depart in terms of how the board might view me in managing the performance of people and the organization, that I was unable to get Tony to stay and be productive.
What was the next communication you had with Dr. Zarnik relating to his resignation?
Well, I asked him some more questions during that meeting. I said, Tony, describe your plan to me. What do you want to do? How soon do you want to leave? How are we going to transition the projects? Do you want to leave in a week or a month or 3 months? What's the phase-out plan? And it was very clear he hadn't thought that through. He said, I don't know. Conditions are just intolerable and I need to leave. I said, why don't you take a day and come back and talk to me tomorrow about it a little more? Put a little more meat on the bones, if you will, how you want to exit the company and how we can orchestrate that that works for both Illumina and for him. He did come back to me the next day.
Now, at this meeting, March 22nd or 23rd, when Dr. Zarnik resigns, did he say he was thinking of resigning?
No.
Did he say he was contemplating resigning?
No, he said, I'm resigning.
Do you have an explanation for the jury why the termination memo made reference to verbiage that said you stated your intention to resign and later withdrew your resignation?
That memo was drafted in conjunction with my attorneys. So that wasn't intended to reflect exactly the conversation that we had. It was just a general description of what had happened.
As you sit here today, are you able to pick out sentence by sentence what portion of the letter was your original input and what portion of the letter may have been anyone else's input?
No, it was jointly developed, so I couldn't identify that specifically.
Now, when Dr. Zarnik returned the following day to discuss the concept of a transition plan, what was the transition plan that he proposed to you?
He said he wanted to leave immediately, and by that he meant literally immediately, and that day, the next day, right away. And he said he wanted 1 year's salary, which in Dr. Zarnik's contract, there is a 1 year's salary provision in his contract, so he wanted 1 year of salary and take all of his stock with him. All the unvested shares he wanted to take with him.
You mean the shares that would have vested over the next several years?
That's right.
What was your response to that proposal?
I was very stunned by that proposal, that he would even consider that. I mean, equity in startup companies is something that you get as a privilege and is something that you earn, and you earn the right to keep that equity by being in the company and participating in the company's success. So the notion he would somehow leave the company and take all his stock with him was unfathomable to me. It was a stunning proposal. I told him so.
Mr. Flatley, when you say equity in the company is something that you get that is earned, do you mean it is earned over the period of time during which it vests?
That's right.
So even though the grant or the right to purchase the full number of shares may have been given on the first date of employment, the actual right to acquire all of those shares is something that is acquired over time, correct?
Yes, that's exactly right. This form of agreement with early employees is to give them the right to buy it to begin with, so that they can get capital gains treatment on the tax side. And that's really why this is done. It's exactly the same as an option that vests over time, except in this case, the company has a right to repurchase. So it's just structured.
Which goes over time?
The right to repurchase goes away as you vest the shares.
So in your own mind, did you want, even though Dr. Zarnik was making a proposal that you found unacceptable, did you still want to try to reach some form of resolution with him?
Sure. My objective at that point was to try to come to whatever amicable parting we could and make it something that Tony thought was fair to him on the one hand, but obviously my response to him as CEO is to be fair to the company and our shareholders and other employees in the organization, so I needed to structure something I thought was reasonable that I could defend to the board of directors.
Is that why you allowed Dr. Zarnik to continue as an employee as you continued severance negotiations?
Exactly, yes.
Let me ask us to put up 164, please. Let's blow up the bottom message, first message. This is Monday, March 27th, a message from Tony Zarnik to you, correct?
Yes.
And he's telling you that he's planning to take a vacation that week, but that he'd be available to talk as needed to talk, correct?
That's right.
This is about being available to talk about what? The severance issues?
Yes. We were in a severance negotiation at this point, so that's what this email refers to.
Let's go to the next message above your response. Blow that up. Now, actually, I'm sorry. Let's go back to the preceding message for a moment. So in Dr. Zarnik's message to you, Mr. Flatley, he states that he's open to negotiating, but on the condition that the company makes a good faith offer. That hasn't happened yet. Do you see that?
Yes.
Does that mean that at this point in time, Dr. Zarnik is the only one who had been making proposals for what it is he might get?
No. I think we had a couple of rounds of discussion by this time, or maybe at least one round of discussion. He opened with a year's worth of salary and all his stock, and I come back with a counterproposal to that. I think what he meant there was that it wasn't big enough to be something he considered a good faith offer.
Now, in your response, in fact, you reference my 3-month proposal. So does that suggest to you that by this date, you in fact had put a 3-month proposal on the table?
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. So what I counter with was 3 months of salary and 3 months of stock vesting, and he could leave as soon as he wanted to leave and walk away with that.
Now, this response on your part also says in the first bullet point, companies don't usually give any severance for employees who resign their positions. Do you see that?
Yes.
Why do you include that bullet point?
Well, severance is usually something that's reserved for a situation where employees are terminated. If an employee leaves voluntarily, companies don't give severance generally for someone who decides to leave a job. So what I was trying to do with Tony is to offer him something. He had been with a company for a while. At the same time, I also had to come to a severance agreement with Rich Pytalewski, and I wanted to be fair to Tony. So I wanted to enter into a severance discussion that I thought was reasonable. However, I qualified that by saying that companies usually don't offer severance at all to people who will voluntarily leave.
Would you have included the verbiage about employees who resign if Dr. Zarnik had not resigned?
No.
Objection, leading.
Sustained, it was leading.
Is there anything about this line, employees who resign their positions, that is inconsistent with what actually happened with Dr. Zarnik?
No, it's totally consistent.
Let's go to Exhibit 166-1. Actually, 166-1. Mr. Flatley, is this an email from you to Dr. Zarnik, March 27th?
Yes.
And you sent this to Dr. Zarnik from the Bay Area?
That's right.
And you were soliciting additional feedback from Dr. Zarnik and inquiring whether you should communicate by email or whether you should wait until you were back in the office Tuesday the 28th, correct?
Correct.
And let's have 166-2. On Monday, March 27th, the day before, we already saw this message about if the company makes a good faith offer. As of Monday, March 27th, you knew that Dr. Zarnik was telling you that he was planning to take some vacation time this week, but severance negotiations were important and he'd be available as needed, correct?
Yes.
Then you learned from some source on March 28th at 9:42 p.m. that Tony Zarnik had submitted a paid time off request for the entire remainder of the week, right?
Yes, my original response to him, to the bottom email, was sent at about 10:50 the night of March 27th. So I got back from that same day, and then I hadn't heard from him on the following day, so I was trying to track him down.
So you were making an effort to try to communicate with him during this week, correct?
Right.
And you then learned that he was going to be out for the rest of the week, correct?
And apparently not checking email, because I had sent a direct response to this email immediately.
And based upon documents you've seen in this litigation, do you have an understanding as to whether or not Dr. Zarnik had a home computer system in his home during the time he was employed by Illumina?
He did, yes.
Because you've seen various documents that he emailed to his home address from Illumina while employed at Illumina, correct?
That's right.
And so let's go ahead to, it's Illumina 0529. It is Dr. Zarnik's April 3rd, 2000 email, which I think it may be 164. Yes, 164. So is it your recollection, Mr. Flatley, that the first response you got back from Tony Zarnik was Monday, even though you were trying to track him down on Tuesday? The first response you got was to your email back to him was a week later, Monday, April 3rd?
Yes, that's correct.
And Dr. Zarnik is saying he just got back to the office from vacation?
Yes.
Does it appear that, and he said, I hoped you would leave me a phone message so I could come in to talk. We could have been working toward an agreement all week, correct?
Yes, that's right.
And you had left him an email, correct?
Yes.
And did this response message, I hope you could leave me a phone message so I could come in to talk, that suggests to you he had been in town that week?
It implies that. I don't know if he was proposing a phone message at home there or his office, but we were typically communicating by email, and that's how I sent his message back to him, to his email.
In his original message, in which he told you he was planning to use some vacation time but would be available to talk as needed, did he say anything in that earlier exhibit about the only way you can communicate with me during that week is by telephone?
No.
Did you have that understanding?
No. In fact, I assumed that email was the appropriate communication mechanism because that's how we'd been doing it all along, before and after this one.
Now, in this response, April 3rd, from Dr. Zarnik, he states that every aspect of my original contract has been reduced in a manner I consider discriminatory and punitive. Do you see that language?
Yes, I do.
When you read that language upon receiving this email, did you believe that Dr. Zarnik was referring to discrimination in the employment, in the legal context in terms of employment law?
No, not at all.
What do you think he meant?
I assumed he meant he used the word discriminatory there in context with the salary change to mean unfair, and that he was trying to imply that he thought I had been unfair in changing his employment agreement.
Now let's go to Exhibit 174. This is on April 5th. Now, Mr. Flatley, are you responsible for... Let me strike that. On or about April 5th, did it come to your attention that Dr. Zarnik had filled out a time card for the preceding week representing that he'd been at work for 40 hours that week?
Yes. The way that works in our company is the supervisor of any employee always approves the time cards for the group of employees that report to him. So I would approve the time cards for anyone who reported to me and reviewed each one every week.
So when you got a time card for Tony Zarnik representing a full work week, the preceding work week, did that raise a red flag for you?
It did.
Because you knew he'd been on vacation, correct?
For at least a portion of this week.
You'd been trying to communicate to him about severance and gotten no response.
That's correct.
You had another response from David Barker in an earlier exhibit that we just saw, indicating that Tony had put in a PTO request for the remainder of that week?
For the entire week, I believe. Yeah.
So was it your intention in sending this email simply to get him to fill out an accurate time record of the time he actually worked?
Yes. I say there, can you let me know the specifics of this? I was just asking, what's the reality of your time last week? Because I didn't know.
Let's go to Exhibit 173. Let's blow up the top part. Blow up the whole thing if we can. This is an email which we've previously seen, Exhibit 173. In this email, Dr. Zarnik again uses the words. He says, I do not agree with your proposed reduction in my compensation and job duties because it's discriminatory. Do you see that?
Yes.
At any point before receiving this email, had Dr. Zarnik ever suggested that he disagreed with his new job duties?
No.
In fact, he was proposing the research fellow position, correct?
He suggested it, yes.
And in this email, this is the first time that Dr. Zarnik mentioned discrimination based on medical condition, correct?
First time I'd ever seen that, yes.
When you saw that, did you know what he was talking about?
I had no idea.
Did you do anything to learn what he might be talking about?
I did. I went to see John Stulpnagel. John was the head of our HR group, and I asked John what he thought that meant.
What did he tell you?
John, at that point, told me for the very first time about the events that had occurred back in April 1999, and the fact that Tony Zarnik had suffered from depression and was on medication for depression.
Is this the first point? And when, in relation to April 5th, the date of this email, do you believe he'd spoken with Dr. Stulpnagel?
I wouldn't be surprised if it was that afternoon. It was pretty quick. I don't recall that exactly, but...
Was that communication with John Stulpnagel the first time that you ever knew that Tony Zarnik had suffered from depression and was on medication for it?
The very first time I ever heard anything about depression.
Or being on medication?
No. Tony had told me early on that he was on medication, and that had happened in the first month that I was at Illumina.
Did he ever specify to you the nature of the medication?
Not at all. It was a very casual comment. He said, I'm on medication, and once in a while I've had a side effect, and if you ever see me acting funny, let me know. That was all.
Did you form any impressions at that time of what he was taking medication for?
I had no idea what that was about. I thought it could have been a skin condition or a rash. I had no idea.
Now, Dr. Zarnik is encouraging you to respond with a counter-proposal for severance, correct?
That's right.
And at any time, so at no time prior to April 5th, 2000, when you are in the middle of severance negotiations, at no time prior to that, had Dr. Zarnik ever expressed to you the view that he was being discriminated against based upon a medical condition. Is that right?
Prior to this date?
Right.
Never.
And on this date, do you remember that you were having difficulty reaching an agreement in the severance negotiations?
Yes. We were not converging very quickly at all.
Let's go to Exhibit 176. Do you recognize this as an... Have you seen this document before?
Yes, I have.
Okay, You recognize this as an email that was sent by Tony Zarnik on April 6th to you, John Stulpnagel, with a copy to David Barker.
Yes.
And in this, Dr. Zarnik is saying he might not have the opportunity to carry on with the Chevron project. Do you see that?
Yes.
Did you understand that to be because he had resigned and would be leaving?
That's what I assumed he meant, yes.
Let me ask you, Mr. Flatley, about the following date, April 7th, 2000. Did you attend a meeting with Dr. Zarnik and his lawyer on that date?
On April 7th, I definitely had a meeting with his lawyer. I don't recall whether Dr. Zarnik was present at that meeting or not. We had at least one where Dr. Zarnik was present. It might have been that same meeting.
And what was the purpose of that meeting?
The purpose was to discuss the severance proposals that were under consideration from both sides.
The lawyer who represented Dr. Zarnik in that meeting was Mr. Pantone?
Yes, it was.
At that point in time, had you retained any counsel to assist you with respect to Dr. Zarnik and the issues raised by him?
We had had some discussions about that, but I don't... Let's see. I don't recall when we actually hired you.
May 12th.
May 12th. So we had not hired you yet.
And were you represented by counsel in that meeting?
I don't believe we were, no.
What happened in the meeting?
Your Honor, I need to approach on this.
I'm sorry?
I need to have a discussion about this.
With the reporter?
Yes.
Yes. Mr. Flatley, do you remember having a meeting with... Mr. Pantone asked you on direct whether you remember a meeting with David Barker, Tony Zarnik, and yourself involving a discussion of his goals, and you indicated you didn't have a recollection of that?
That's right.
Do you have a recollection of a meeting involving the three of you?
The three being Dr. Barker...
Zarnik, Flatley.
Yes. We had a meeting on April 17th with the three of us.
What was the purpose of that meeting?
It was to discuss the severance proposals and what the status of those proposals were. We had made an offer on April 7th, and the date of this follow-up meeting was April 17th, and we hadn't heard anything in 10 days, so I was anxious to get some feedback from Tony about whether we were making any progress.
I'd like to ask you to put up Exhibit 184.
There's an objection to this.
Is there? Take it down. Let me just ask you to refer to Exhibit 184 in your notebook.
Okay.
Are these your handwritten notes from that April 17th, 2000 meeting?
Yes, they are.
And don't read from the notes, but can you summarize, up until the point when there was any lawyer involvement, can you summarize what happened in the meeting between you, David Barker, and Tony Zarnik?
Well, we had made this offer to Tony that I had described from April 7th, and so I asked Tony whether he was prepared to accept our offer.
And your offer was an offer for what?
Was what I call the 6-6 offer, so 6 months of salary and 6 months of stock.
So by this point, April 17th, you doubled the offer you had made earlier in the month.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I was, I guess, pessimistic at that point, because we hadn't heard anything from Tony in 10 days. It had been radio silence for all that time. So I better stop there, I guess.
At that point, there had been 10 days elapsed between the first offer, between your offer and this meeting?
That's right.
And you said that at this point, there was some lawyer involvement, that Tony Zarnik had stepped out, involved a lawyer?
Yes.
What happened in the next, between you, Barker, and Zarnik?
Tony came back and said he would not accept our offer, but that he would talk to his lawyer overnight and come back with a counterproposal, and believed he said he would tell us about that the next day.
Now let me jump ahead a little bit and ask you a question about this. These allegations of discrimination based upon medical condition. The first time you ever learned he was making that contention was April 5th, 2000, correct?
April 7th.
Whatever date exhibit is reflected. It's April 5th, Exhibit 173.
The first time the medical condition.
The first time the words medical condition was used appears to be Exhibit 173?
I'm sorry, April 5th.
Mr. Flatley, can you explain to the jury why no formal investigation was done once you'd received the email from Tony Zarnik claiming discrimination based upon medical condition?
Well, at this point, the context of this discussion was in... It was all in the context of a severance discussion, so we're going back and forth on severance debates, and this email that had come in just before this one had talked about discrimination and the fact it was related to the change in job duties and his change in compensation. The decision to make those changes was done unilaterally by me, so there was no one else that had made that decision. So frankly, there was no one to investigate, because I was the person who had made the call with regard to the changes on the job duties and with regard to his changes in compensation.
Well, at the time you made the decision about changes in job duties, changes in compensation, at the time you made those decisions, which he was now claiming to be discriminatory, had you any information about Dr. Zarnik's medical condition at the time you made those decisions?
No, I had none. And additionally, by this time, we were starting to get lawyers involved on both sides to handle the negotiation between Tony and the company.
So let me ask you, when you saw Tony Zarnik's April 5th email in which he's claiming that these changes were being done on account of his medical condition, you knew, as you just testified, that you were the person who made the decisions, right?
That's right.
And you knew that you had no information about his medical condition at the time you made the decisions.
I had not.
So you knew that your decisions could not have been based upon his medical condition.
That's right. And in retrospect, I probably should have conducted an investigation. But at that time, the context of the information I had at hand didn't seem like that was appropriate. We were at the point where we were hoping we'd reach a quick agreement on severance, and Tony would leave maybe within a day or 2 days, so we did not launch a formal investigation for that reason.
Let me ask you this. Did you view, whether rightly or wrongly, did you view Dr. Zarnik's email to you in which he alleges discrimination on account of medical condition as a complaint of discrimination?
Well, in retrospect, I guess certainly you could view it that way. But when it came in the context of the information I had at that point, I didn't view it as a complaint in a formal way. But certainly in retrospect, I would.
You would do things differently today?
Absolutely.
And Mr. Flatley, you keep saying in the context in which I got this information. Let me ask you the blunt question. Did you view Tony Zarnik's allegations of discrimination made to you in the context of the severance negotiations to be a genuine complaint of discrimination?
Not at all. I mean, I thought that the comments he was making in these emails were intending to act as leverage in our negotiations on severance, and that's really the context I viewed them in at that time.
Did you view them to be veiled threats?
Absolutely.
Objection. Leading.
It is leading. Sustained.
Now, Mr. Flatley, you testified that after the severance negotiations really reached an impasse, you determined that Dr. Zarnik had really not been doing much work during the negotiations, right?
Well, there was virtually no work I'm aware of that occurred between his time of resignation, which was on the 22nd or 23rd of March, and the period of early May. So there's a period here of 6 weeks or so where virtually the only thing that was happening was that Tony was talking to lawyers and talking to me about severance. There was no work being accomplished.
Once you reached the impasse, you determined that you needed to give Dr. Zarnik some specific goals to begin working on, correct?
That's right.
Who did the first draft of the goals?
Tony did the first draft of the goals and submitted them to Dr. Barker, because at that time he was reporting in to Dr. Barker.
Did you understand that once... But on or about May 4th, Dr. Zarnik began reporting to you, correct?
That's correct.
I'll hold off on the exhibit. So even though Dr. Zarnik was going to be reporting to you, did you still intend to have his individual goals reviewed and commented upon by David Barker?
Yes. I was asking David's opinion on the goals, so he was involved in helping me set the final goals.
In setting these goals, did you make an attempt... Well, in setting the goals, did you intend to give Dr. Zarnik goals which were aggressive?
Yes.
Now, there was one issue that was brought up by Mr. Pantone, and he said, isn't it true that with respect to the binary oligo encoding goal, no work had ever been done on that goal in the company at the time the goal was assigned, correct?
Yes.
Had any preliminary work been done in the company which would have completed part of what needed to be done toward that goal?
Yes. In fact, the reason we included that goal is because we judged it to be easier than the one that Tony Zarnik had submitted. So he submitted a proposal to do antibody encoding and decoding and enzyme-based decoding as the two types of decoding. We substituted for enzyme the binary oligo, and the reason that decision was made is because the whole company was focused on trying to get the oligo-based decoding up and running. We had in all the algorithms to do the analysis, the imaging systems, the methodology how you would attach oligos to bead. So the entire infrastructure had been brought up well before that to enable us to do oligo encoding, and to do binary oligo encoding was just an incremental step.
This might be simplifying it a bit, but you had already developed the technology by which you could attach beads to the wells, single oligos or single types of oligos to the beads, and then decode them.
Objection, leading.
Sustained.
Can you describe for us what had already been accomplished with respect to oligo decoding?
Asked and answered an answer ago, Judge. Two answers ago.
Overruled.
The company had developed all the core technologies, and they were up and running and being used. So we knew how to put oligos on beads, knew how to weld arrays by putting beads in wells, knew how to image those, analyze the image, how to extract, how to do clustering, and analyze the resulting data. The entire infrastructure was operational to allow one to do binary oligo encoding, except for the part related to that slight change of doing it in a binary way rather than single.
When you say doing it in a binary way, essentially what you were asking Dr. Zarnik to do, which never had been done before, was to attach two oligos types to a single bead rather than one?
Two or more. There are multiple ways of doing this binary encoding method. Dr. Zarnik was proposing a method where I would attach five different types of oligos to a bead.
Were you anticipating he would start just attaching two types to each bead?
Two or three. You could do it in multiple different ways.
Now let's put up Exhibit 304. Not the entire thing, but just the portion that was included before. I think it's on page 15. So this is the portion of the DFEH response, which Mr. Pantone examined you on?
Yes.
And you, in fact, did review and give final approval to my law firm to submit the response on behalf of Illumina, correct?
Correct.
Now, Mr. Flatley, to the best of your knowledge, were you the only person who provided input or review or approval of this letter?
No. There were multiple people who participated in this. In fact, the person who did most of the input was John Stulpnagel, because the claims asserted in this had largely to do with these events that occurred back in April 1999, where I wasn't even involved in the company. So I had no knowledge of most of the facts related to this complaint.
Mr. Pantone focused upon this verbiage. Our position is that Dr. Zarnik instead proceeded directly to file with the department, perhaps advising coworkers days beforehand that he was planning to do so. At the time that you approved this language, which I wrote, had you conducted a comprehensive review of the company's email servers to ascertain whether or not Dr. Zarnik ever sent emails concerning this issue?
No, we hadn't really done a full review of our email system at this point.
Isn't it true, Mr. Flatley, that the DFEH response document prepared by my law firm is a document of approximately 15 single-space pages?
That sounds about right.
Let's go to just a discussion about the goals. Let me jump back to another topic. There was a board of directors meeting in April 2000?
Yes.
Was there any discussion whatsoever about Tony Zarnik in that meeting?
Yes, there was.
What was said? No, not what was said. What did you say, if anything, about Tony Zarnik?
I discussed the fact that we were anticipating Tony was going to be leaving the company, that we were in severance negotiations, that we had had a number of back-and-forth iterations on the subject of severance, and we were trying to reach an agreement with him. I told him that the number that I thought was fair and the limit of what I was willing to do was 6 months of salary and 6 months of stock. And then we had a board discussion about what was appropriate from there. And that was the time that the board decided to try to have David Walt intervene as an intermediary to try to get this settled and to offer up 9 months and 9 months.
Did you, in this board of directors meeting or any other board of directors meeting, did you say that Tony Czarnik was going to be given goals that he would not be able to achieve?
I never said that to anyone.
Did you ever say that individually to any board member?
No.
Did you ever say, either in a group meeting or individually to any director, that Tony Czarnik had claimed to have a disability but you didn't believe him?
No.
Do you disbelieve that Dr. Czarnik has a disability?
I've never had any reason to disbelieve that once I became aware of it.
During the meeting in which goals were assigned, what date is it that you were intending to assign the goals to Dr. Czarnik?
We were set to assign the goals at our regularly scheduled meeting on May 18th.
Let me ask you this. We've seen it already, and in the interest of time, I'm not going to put up every document we've seen. But this afternoon, we've seen, or this morning, we saw the message from Tony Czarnik advising you on the 17th that he might be late for your meeting on the 18th, correct?
That's correct.
Actually, let's put that one up. That is the 517 email from Tony Czarnik to Jay Flatley, Exhibit 222. Do you recognize this as an email that you received from Tony Czarnik on May 17th?
Yes.
And he was advising you that he might be late for the meeting, correct?
That's right.
And he states, "At our meeting, I'd like to discuss your thought on the job description I wrote, my goals, and an update on my work." Do you see that?
Yes.
Was it understood between the two of you that at the meeting on May 17th, you would be discussing goals?
The intent was to do that on the meeting of May 18th, the day after this, yes.
Is it true by the time of the meeting on May 18th, the scheduled meeting on May 18th at 4 p.m., the goals which were actually delivered to Dr. Czarnik were already prepared?
Yes.
Were they already in written form?
Yes.
Had he shown up at the meeting at 4 p.m., would you have been prepared to hand him the same document which you ended up delivering to him the following day?
Yes.
And the only reason you didn't do that is why?
Because he didn't show up for the meeting.
So you did it the following day?
Right.
To the extent there's been any implication to this effect, did you deliver your goals, the goals to Dr. Czarnik, on May 19th, to retaliate against him for having gone to the DFEH?
Absolutely not.
Those goals were already prepared?
Yeah, and they'd been discussed numerous times in advance of this.
When you gave him the goals on May 19th, did he object to any of them at that time?
No.
My paralegal just handed me a note suggesting, but I need to clear it with the court, that given the fact we didn't get started promptly at 20 of, that if I continue until 4:12 p.m., that would give me still within the time limit. I'm wondering if I can count on that.
Pardon?
Because we didn't get started promptly at 20 of 3, may...
I thought you were going to be done at 4 o'clock if we started at 20 of 3, so go to 4:05.
I'll do what I can. Mr. Flatley, you at some point received that DFEH chart, which we had up on the screen a little while ago?
Yes.
After you received the charge of discrimination from Tony Czarnik, who was at that point still an employee, correct?
Correct.
Did you form the impression at that point that you would be firing him?
No.
Why not?
Because he was on a performance program and we were measuring him versus his goals. The complaint wasn't relevant to what he was doing under his goals.
Let me ask you to... Let's talk about the performance management against goals. These were delivered to Dr. Czarnik on May 19th?
That's correct.
Did he express any confusion or misunderstanding about when these goals were to begin in effect?
Not until sometime later.
When later?
About 2 or 3 weeks later, he said, "I didn't really think you meant for me to start these right away because I was taking a vacation 2 weeks later." So for some reason, he assumed they didn't start until after his vacation.
Now, to your understanding, the goals were in effect immediately, correct?
Immediately, yes.
The 30-day feedback would have been around June 19th, correct?
That's the day the feedback and his first goals were due, yes.
Did you get anything from him relating to his first set of goals on or about June 19th?
No.
When did you finally receive any work product relating to Dr. Zarnik's first set of goals?
The major deliverable for the 30-day goals were these work plans, and the first time that I received those was after I was on the roadshow, which was around July 11th or 12th.
Now, did Dr. Zarnik at some point... You've just testified he expressed a belief that the goals actually didn't start for another 2 weeks or so.
Right.
In your first weekly meeting with Dr. Zarnik after the assignment of the goals, did he ask you for another set of goals?
Actually, it was a few meetings after that that we got together, and I believe it might have even been the meeting that was targeted for the 30-day review. He came into that meeting. He had no paper, no pencil, no notebook, no copy of the goals. He had nothing in hand. And when I asked him specifically to give me the deliverables for the 30-day goals, he said, he acted very surprised and said, "Can I get another copy of those?"
Did that give you the impression he had done nothing toward those goals?
It was worse than that. He hadn't done anything, and it's almost like he didn't remember he had goals.
And so even by Dr. Zarnik's count, if the goals had not gone into effect until June 1st, would his 30-day deliverables have been due on or about July 1st?
Yes.
Even though you were on vacation during that week encompassing July 1st, were you doing work?
Yes.
And if you had received the deliverables relating to 30-day goals on or about July 1st, would you have had time to provide any feedback concerning those goals before he left on the roadshow?
I certainly would have had some time to do that. I might have not done a totally thorough review, but I certainly got some initial feedback to him.
So you say the first point in time which you received a major deliverable, which was the work plans for relating to the two experimental goals, was while you were on the roadshow?
That's right.
And isn't it true, Mr. Flatley, that these work plans were documents whereby you were expecting Dr. Zarnik to lay out the design of the experiment, the budget, the time frames, what he'd need to do the experiments? In other words, to explain what he intended to do and how he intended to do it?
Exactly, yes.
You received those while on the roadshow, correct?
Correct.
Did you have time to open up and read these documents while you were on the roadshow?
I believe I probably opened the email and did maybe a 30-second scan of what was there, but I didn't really have a chance to do it in any detail or provide any feedback.
In fact, did you forward Dr. Zarnik's email with his work plan attachments to your assistant, Carmilla?
Yeah, there were some attachments to the work plan that were, I think, large images, so I didn't even have time to download those. I maybe downloaded some headers. I ordinarily forwarded them to Carmilla. I think I maybe asked for her to print them and forward them off to me by mail, or at least put them in my box. I don't recall what I asked her to do.
Now, during the period of time that you were on the roadshow... Actually, let's put up 266 before I go to the roadshow. Do you recognize this as an email sent by you to Tony Zarnik on July 9th?
Yes.
And you indicated that on June 27th, he was already more than a week late on delivery of his 30-day goals, correct?
That's right.
That's using a start date of May 19th, correct?
That's correct.
Isn't it true that even with a start date of June 1st, By Sunday, July 9th, you still had not received the 30-day deliverables?
That's correct.
So he was late, even by his own start date measure.
By any standard, he was late.
Now let's focus on the roadshow for a moment. During the month of July, most of the month of July, you were on the roadshow.
That's right.
Do you have a recollection, Mr. Flatley, of how many cities you visited during roadshow?
I think it was something like 17 cities, something like that.
And you started that roadshow in Frankfurt, Germany?
We made two presentations in New York and jumped on a plane, flew immediately over to Europe, and started right when we got to Europe in Frankfurt, yes.
As a generalization, how many presentations was the team making each day?
Probably the minimum was 5 or 6, and a maximum probably 12 in a given day.
And when I say making presentations, does it mean that anywhere from 5 to 12 times a day, you were making the same pitch or same presentation to various groups?
Yeah, it was exactly the same.
You had done a roadshow before, correct?
Yes. I had led the roadshow at Molecular Dynamics in 1993.
Did you strive to say the same thing in presentations in each presentation?
Yeah. The goal of a roadshow is to, as consistently as possible, communicate the company's story. So that's why we had the prospectus to read. And the goal of the management team is to try to communicate verbally, using exactly the same materials, the same story, every investor.
During the roadshow, isn't it true you received an email from Mark Chi reporting on the most recent results of the most recent iteration of the 768 Decode experiments?
Yes.
Did you use any of that information on the roadshow?
No, we didn't.
Did you, before leaving for the roadshow, when you asked Mark Chi to keep you apprised of experimental results in your absence, did you have any intention of using any new experimental results in the roadshow?
No. Our roadshow was totally prepared. It was practiced over and over and over. It was absolutely a rote process. I could have done it in my sleep. And we weren't... The only corrections we would make to the roadshow were things that, you know, we had gotten some direct feedback from the bankers the day before we left.
Can you explain to the jury, let's just say, hypothetically, you'd gotten some results that were very scientifically exciting and very positive. Can you explain to the jury why you would still not have changed the content of your roadshow presentation in future presentations?
Object. That calls for speculation.
I think it does. I think it's a hypothetical question.
Let me frame it a different way. Mr. Flatley, is there any kind of scientific information that you think would be appropriate to add into the roadshow presentation midstream?
Same objection.
Overruled.
No, there's no material that you really can add to the roadshow while you are on the roadshow, because legally, you don't want to give investors different information. So it's not reasonable to tell the first 10 investors something and then tell the last 10 investors something different or add a lot of new content to the roadshow. The goal is to be absolutely, one, consistent, and as legally consistent as you possibly can be, because then everybody has exactly the same view of the company and can make an equivalent decision whether to invest in this opportunity.
That's why, no matter what the quality of scientific information that might be received on the roadshow, you would keep the presentation the same as it was all the way through?
That's right. This was a very non-technical presentation. The goal of these roadshows, investors are not scientists. They're not people who understand technical material. So the goal, both in writing the document and in preparing the roadshow, is to get out as much scientific information as you can and make it much more business, very high level, so the people can understand the story.
Let me ask you this. Did you ever specifically direct that the 768 experiment that was... Now, we've already established there were a number of experiments that involved the attempted decoding of 768 bead types, correct? Actually, isn't it true all the experiments through the summer of 2000 were experiments which were geared at demonstrating the feasibility of decoding that many bead types?
The goal of these experiments is to increasingly increase the number of beads. So they were trying to show we could decode large numbers of beads, increasing numbers of beads. Consistently hitting 768 was not the goal. It was to decode as many as you could. If we hit 768, that would have been a miracle. We tried to hit as many as we possibly could out of that to show we could decode a lot of bead types.
Around Illumina, did you ever hear these experiments referred to as the roadshow experiments?
Never.
When was the first time that you ever heard of these experiments referred to as roadshow experiments?
During my deposition with Tony Pantone.
And he used that term in a question to you?
Yes.
Now, you've already testified that you did learn about the dye mislabeling issue.
Yes, correct.
Did you have a conversation about the mislabeled dye?
Correct.
Did you have a conversation with Dr. Zarnik about the labeled dye?
Correct. After I came back from the roadshow, he came into my office and wanted to be sure I knew about this. I said, I don't remember how I found out about it, but it was post-roadshow, and Tony was very interested in trying to recover the money we had spent on these dyes from our vendor. So he asked me, can and should I go try to recover this money? I said, great, do it. He did, and got the money back.
Did Dr. Zarnik express to you at that time a concern that misleading data had been shown to investors on the roadshow?
No.
Separate and apart from that one discussion about the mislabeled dyes, as you sit here today, did Dr. Zarnik ever express to you he had a concern that investors on the roadshow might have been misled by any information we've heard represented?
He never said that to me.
Now, during the period of time after you got back from the roadshow and continuing up in time to the termination meeting on September 5th, you were meeting with Dr. Zarnik on virtually a weekly basis, correct?
Correct.
He never raised this issue about fraud on investors in any meeting with you?
Never.
Did anybody else communicate to you that he had raised that concern with them?
No.
Now let's put up Exhibit 283. Let's blow it up. Mr. Flatley, is this a memo to you, from you, to Tony Zarnik, with your feedback on his 30-day goals?
Yes, it is.
And why is it dated August 1st, 2000?
Because I was gone from the office virtually the entire month of July. First on vacation the first week, and then on the roadshow. So this was right after I returned.
And you indicate that the plan on the immunocoding technology issue was received on or about July 11th while you were on the roadshow, correct?
That's correct.
Now, similarly, the work plan for the binary oligo encoding project was also not received until July 11th while you were on the roadshow, correct?
That's correct.
You were acknowledging with respect to both you owed him feedback.
That's correct.
By this date, August 1st, you'd been back in the office from being gone for about a month for all of a couple of days, correct?
Yes, and there was a weekend in between, so July 29th was a Saturday and the 30th was a Sunday.
Let's go down to the last item, which was Dr. Zarnik's third goal. It was to develop an idea for a grant application and outline grant objectives. On questioning by Mr. Pantone, there was some questioning about whether you knew that Dr. Zarnik had had a breakdown at an earlier point in time when he was working on a grant application, correct?
Correct.
Mr. Flatley, was the decision to give... Now, you understood that that breakdown had to do with the change in medication and not the grant application, correct?
That's right.
You heard Dr. Zarnik's direct testimony that he had verified that.
That's right.
So was the assignment for, in addition to his goals, grant application work, in any way done to be malicious, hurtful, or harmful?
No, just an attempt to try to raise additional funds for the company and something that might be related to a great invention he might come up with as part of this program.
Did you feel that somebody who was a high-level research scientist, that it was a reasonable expectation to ask him to prepare a grant application per quarter?
Yes, absolutely.
Let's go to Exhibit 291. Mr. Flatley, do you recognize Exhibit 291 as another memo you sent to Tony Zarnik on or about August 8th?
Yes, I do.
This is your feedback for him on his 60-day goals, which had been due mid-July, correct?
Correct.
And even by his standard, if they didn't begin until June 1st, they would have been due August 1st.
That's right.
And isn't it true that a number of these goals, the 60-day goals, were also not achieved?
Right. In fact, most of the 30-day goals were still not achieved at this point.
And the experimental 60-day goals, numbers 1 and 2, still were not achieved.
That's right. In fact, by this point, it was beginning to become clear there was literally no effort going into making these goals.
Now, let's go to the second page of this exhibit. On the second page of this memo, written August 8th, 2000, you say, "In addition to reviewing of 60-day goals, I provided you feedback on your binary optical coding plan."
Yes.
Verbally in this, you communicated your feedback on that work plan that you received?
Yes.
In this email, in this memo, you were clearly advising Dr. Zarnik that you were trying to provide him with support and ongoing feedback. You expressed a concern about the lack of progress, did you not?
I did.
And you expressed that it was a great concern, right?
Right.
You wanted to provide him with assistance, and you suggested that if a neutral facilitator would be helpful in the weekly meetings, that was something you were willing to do?
Correct.
And at the very end here, you indicate that a failure to make significant progress toward completing your unfinished 30, 60-day goals and toward your 90-day goals would result in a re-evaluation of his continued role at Illumina and could result in termination?
Correct.
You didn't say a failure to attain all of those goals would result in his termination, did you?
No. I thought we set aggressive goals, and the expectation was not he would finish every one of them and finish them successfully. We expected a tremendous effort and a great experiment. Could be we discovered there was a problem with one of them, and we'd take a different direction. The big challenge here, there was no experiment. There was no experimental results to look at, and Tony was, more or less, ignoring these goals.
I guess my real question, Mr. Flatley, is this. By this point in time, August 8th, Dr. Zarnik was already significantly behind in his 30-day goals, right?
Right.
He was behind in his 60-day goals?
That's right.
And I guess my question is, at this point in time, were you looking... I mean, although obtaining and hitting these goals would have been ideal, isn't it true what you were really looking for and what you communicated to him that you were looking for was progress towards these goals?
That's right.
And if by the 90-day mark, Tony Zarnik had made significant progress and effort toward the goals and had not attained them, would you advise...
Objection. Speculation.
Sustained.
What would you have required in order... What were you looking for from Dr. Zarnik in order to turn around the trend that you were seeing by this point?
I would have expected Dr. Zarnik to produce some significant experimental results on both the first two objectives that showed early phase feasibility of those. I would have expected, based on the feedback I gave him on the work plans, to make the work plans something other than a superficial document, which is what they were when they were submitted to me. I would have expected him to conduct some analytical analysis using some modeling to determine the feasibility of some of the things that we were trying to do, and had shown some significant effort toward achieving these objectives.
When did you reach the decision to terminate Dr. Zarnik's employment?
August 29th.
Was there any specific event or incident that prompted you to reach that conclusion?
Yes, it was our review. I think this was about 100 days into this, a review meeting with Tony, asked him for experimental results. He couldn't show me any. The progress was... There was no progress. It was unbelievable to me. I asked him to go get his laboratory notebook to show me what he had put in his lab notebook. Through 100 days of work, there were 6 pages of entries in his lab notebook. To document that, I actually initialed and witnessed his notebook on those 6 pages. And then I asked him to produce for me any other supporting material that he had that was evidence of his work towards his goals. Any analytical work he had done on Excel, any experimental results, any quality control data on reagents, anything else he had that could show me that he was actually doing any work.
Did he ever provide you with any of those materials?
The afternoon of September 5th, the day I terminated him, a small package arrived in my box that were quality control traces from outside vendors.
That was it?
There were a few other small documents in there, but... By that time, we were past the point of no return.
In fact, at some point early, in fact, on or about August 30th, after you had requested that Dr. Zarnik provide you with any additional evidence that he'd been doing work, what is it that he provided you on that date?
He gave me what we call a self-assessment, which is part of our performance appraisal process. We ask employees to do a self-assessment, what they think about what they've done. And so, in response to my request for hard information about the experiments and data, I got his own review of himself.
And in self-review, did he rank himself as performing quite well?
Oh, yeah.
So on September 5th, 2000, you had the termination meeting with Dr. Zarnik and Deborah Flamino present.
That's correct.
In that termination meeting, I think we've been through it, But do you deny making a statement to Dr. Zarnik about his expressing concerns about decoding?
Yes, I never had to say that.
But you did tell him broadly he needed to keep all public information about the company confidential?
I reminded him of his obligation under his non-disclosure agreement with the company, and that it was absolutely his responsibility to make sure he maintained all information about the company as confidential.
What was Dr. Zarnik's demeanor like during this termination meeting?
Relatively passive. I think he expected it and was not a surprise to him.
Thank you. I would have things further, but given the time constraint we've agreed to, I'll have to end at this point.
Mr. Pantone, theoretically you've used up all your time.
I'm awfully tired, and I know the jury is awfully tired, too. I've got a few questions. I've got it on one sheet of paper. Try to do it in 5 minutes or so.
Okay.
Or so.
Or so.